Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's been the talk of the nation. The Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings reached a crescendo this week as the Senate committee heard from a California professor who's accused the Supreme Court nominee of sexual misconduct, a charge he denies. We get local reaction. And we talk high tech with one of Apple University's experts who's been in town giving talks across the University of Hawaii campus. He's a business historian, and his thoughts about tech might surprise you. And do you like wood, Hawaiian woods in particular? Well, we check in on a new exhibit at the Honolulu Museum of Art. The Woodworker Show is always a big draw. We talk about what's in store for you this year. It's September 28th, day 3 of our Pledge Drive this fall. Join us for our Aloha Friday conversation. We'll be right back after the headlines. Earlier this morning, the Senate Judiciary Committee voted along party lines to advance the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. However, a final vote won't be scheduled until an FBI investigation has been completed. The Senate Judiciary Committee spent nearly 9 hours hearing testimony and asking questions. Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh responded to allegations of sexual assault from his accuser, Christine Blasey Ford. Now, at the University of Hawaii's Richardson School of Law, a group of students watched the hearing live yesterday. HPR's Ryan Finnerty was there.
UH Law professor Linda Krieger canceled her morning class, organized a live screening, and led a discussion of the Kavanaugh hearing as it played out. During a break in the questioning, she told me how she has been using the hearings as a teachable moment.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that's very hard for law students to learn, but that's critical in working with people when they're going from being concerned citizens to being lawyers, is to understand how procedure and how institutions influence outcomes, right? We think of outcomes as being entirely reflective of the merits of the facts, but the way a process gets set up, the procedural rules, the evidentiary rules, the structures of the process have a huge impact on what happens. And one of the things that I hope our students will understand from being able to watch what's going on right now in Congress is that if we destroy our institutions, right, for partisan gain on either side, right, if we violate norms of collegiality, of inclusion, of fair adversarialism, if we allow the party in power, whichever party it is, to structure what are the rules going to be, who's going to testify, what evidence is going to come in, then we're going to lose that which makes our system special. I hope that our students will see from this that it's not just important that they be politically involved. They have to be the people who protect the institutions, who protect the rules of evidence, who protect the rules of civil procedure, who protect norms of collegiality, who protect norms of inclusion, right, who say no to hyper-partisanship and outcome orientation. And that's what I think is so special about this moment as a teaching moment, is people can understand how the things that they're studying in other classes that might seem kind of abstract and unimportant are critically important to how things turn out in the real world. Like right now, as they're watching Dr. Blasey Ford's testimony, and now they're watching Judge Kavanaugh's testimony. The Senate, the committee leadership, Senator Grassley and the people he's working with, structured this hearing so that all that came in that suggested that these events occurred as Dr. Blasey Ford said they occurred was her testimony. Right, her opening statement and her testimony. And that went first, right? They heard that first. After she testified. They then had Judge Kavanaugh's live testimony, Judge Kavanaugh's calendars, statements of four people who were not present at the hearing and so whose statements couldn't be cross-examined, all tending to support Judge Kavanaugh's position that the events hadn't occurred. So the committee chair, Senator Grassley, has sort of preset what the record is going to be by what they allowed to come into the hearing and what they didn't. So there's no way that that's not going to allow them to conclude that these events didn't happen or that the evidence is so imbalanced as to whether it happened or not.
During his statements, Brett Kavanaugh referred to the proceedings as a circus and said that his treatment would deter young people from public service in the future. I asked Professor Krieger what she thought about that claim.
Look, I think if anyone expects to be seriously considered for membership on the United States Supreme Court, they have to expect their entire life to be placed under a microscope. So I actually think that calling the proceeding a circus is unfair, is destructive of trust in our institutions, and is designed simply to distract from the merits of the decision that needs to be made.
Aris Springs is a second-year law student at UH, originally from Guam. He also disagreed with Kavanaugh's stance.
Well, I don't think that it's going to deter you if you haven't done anything bad, you know? I mean, I feel like if I ever applied for to be a judge, I would hope that, I wouldn't have anything like this on me. I mean, it just makes sense. It would deter people, but more than likely it's going to deter people who have committed some type of, sexual assault of some kind. I feel like if anything, it's good. It holds people accountable. It holds, it makes people think twice before they actually go forward with, going into a position where you're going to have some control, a large control over people's lives,
Renette Kawakami is an attorney and associate dean at the Richardson Law School. She says that law students can learn more than just professional lessons from this situation.
It's not just political. There's an important professional responsibility component to this. How do I conduct myself even before you even think about going to law school? Am I a good person? Am I going out and getting horribly drunk and not remembering what I did the night before? How I treat others, and not just the people that are my friends, but how you treat everyone, just because someone's not from the same social status as you. So this is what we try to teach our students, this professionalism, this professional responsibility, that you don't just be nice to those who are privileged or run in your privileged circles. You need to be good to everyone. So this is an important lesson for all our students from the historical viewpoint, also from the personal, the kind of people that they're going to be, the kind of lawyers they're going to be, the kind of movers and shakers, hopefully leaders of the community that they will be.
Despite the bitter partisanship on display at the hearing, Professor Krieger expressed hope that we can return to an environment of civility in public discourse.
I am very hopeful that the generation of people who are now in college, in law school, that they will restore trust and collegiality and mutual respect, because I think right now a tremendous amount of damage has been done and continues to be done. And so it's going to be critically important that young people understand what's at stake in terms of norms and collegiality and civility and cooperation across the aisle, and that they restore that tradition.
Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
And that was local reaction to the Kavanaugh hearings. As we mentioned, the Judiciary Committee advanced the nomination earlier this morning on a party line vote. However, the final confirmation vote on Brett Kavanaugh's nomination has been delayed for a week to allow for the FBI to conduct investigation.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Waldorf Fair, Honolulu Waldorf School's annual family fair with children's activities, live music, and food Saturday, October 27th from 11 to 3. Open to the public. HonoluluWaldorf.org.
High tech and the digital divide. That's the subject of talks this week by a visiting professor. Richard Tedlow is a business historian, an endowed professor at Harvard Law School, and for the last several years, he's been at Apple University. He just retired from that post last month. Now, he spoke at the UH Law School and at the Schuyler School of Business about what lies ahead.
Certainly, in Silicon Valley, the term you hear most often is artificial intelligence. So a lot of companies are spending a lot of money and making a lot of big bets that artificial intelligence is the future. Exactly what that means depends on whom you speak with. It's difficult to do. There is a lot of talk about self-driving cars. Once again, there's a gap between promise and performance. The promise is wonderful. Whether we're actually going to get, real level 5 autonomy, in other words, cars that you just walk into, tell it where to go, and you don't have a steering wheel, whether we're going to get that before the next ice age, and we're having global warming now, that remains to be seen.
But it's the whole George Jetson thing, and when you start thinking about, gosh, we could have, flying cars.
Well, if some of these changes can be made, it would be great for society. It would be great for the elderly, like me. I'm 71. It would be great for people with disabilities. It would be enormously liberating. And that's the real promise of big tech, is liberation. Thanks to app development, for example, on the phone, you can be homebound for any number of reasons and be an entrepreneur. That's new in this world, and to me, it's a tremendous step forward and a wonderful contribution to society.
It's scary, but it's also exciting. I mean, I think of Downton Abbey and Carson the butler staring at the toaster.
Yes,
you had such social upheaval at that time, women got the right to vote. You had cars. I mean, just a remarkable time. And there's a parallel here, it seems like. I mean, there's just so much incredible good that could come of this, and then there's also the bad.
Yes. The social changes that were, if I may cite Downton Abbey again, since you brought it up, there's a wonderful line in there where Maggie Smith, who's sort of the Dowager Duchess, my recollection is, her grand, the man who winds up marrying Lady Mary, whose name now slips my mind, forgive me.
Matthew,
thank you very much. Talks about something happening on a weekend, and she says, "What is a weekend?" And but personally, I don't live that life, and haven't lived that life. But that's the life that when you were an upper class aristocrat in Britain in the 19th century, it didn't matter.
Right. What's a weekend?
Yeah, somebody was taking care of everything. We're in the midst of transitions that are as dramatic as that. You can communicate with anybody anywhere now. I think the question is, what do you have to say? The definition of broadcasting has changed tremendously. So, for example, you can tweet to if you're a public figure to 50 million people or more, and yet if you're not someone who pays any attention to that, you're completely out of that. So, in a sense, high tech has greatly expanded the reach, but in a sense, it's also narrowed it. It's expanded it. But the river's longer, but it's narrower. If you don't happen to follow somebody, then you don't know what's going on. And there were certain advantages to the era of the 1960s and the 1970s, where we had true broadcasting, where everybody watched ABC, CBS, NBC, and then finally CNN, because there was a certain sense that everybody was getting the same information.
Right, and before that it was radio, where we all listened to the radio.
That's correct.
Before there was TV.
That's correct. It took a long time for people to understand what radio was. I mean, they understood it from a mechanical and from an engineering standpoint, but You know, one idea was that it was going to be a telephone booth of the air, that you were going to walk into a telephone booth, literally put in a coin or two, and then just talk to people who were going to follow you, which is a little like social media today. Social media does allow you to express yourself to a large number of people, but it also allows something called cyberbullying, which when I was growing up didn't exist, and is real, and is awful.
But you've just retired from Apple University, and you're not on social media.
I am not.
Explain yourself.
I'm an historian, and one of the things you learn when you study history is that you march backward into the future. And to a certain extent, that's what I'm doing. I like my privacy, number one. And number two, I just find it hard to believe that the friends that I have would be really interested in the fish that I had last night. It doesn't appeal to me.
Do you use an iPhone?
Oh, yes, very much so. Among the things that I find appealing about the iPhone, and this is something interesting about Apple as a company, is I like the aesthetics of it. I think it's beautiful. For a lot of people, an iPhone is today a camera with a phone attached, and a lot of them use it for gaming. A lot of them use it for texting. I actually use it for talking. And when the iPhone was introduced, which was in 2007, if you looked at Steve Jobs' keynote introducing it, the camera was a 2-megapixel rear-facing camera, and it was not part of the value proposition at all. In other words, Apple as a company learned from its users what that phone was going to become, and that's intriguing. Take a look at one of the beautiful sunsets that you have in Hawaii. Everybody's out there with their cameras, and those cameras are all attached to phones. Not all of them, but many of them. Because the truth is that the cameras on the iPhones are really superb.
They really are.
And the number of photographs that are uploaded to the cloud, I have no idea, frankly, what the number is, but if it were in the billions daily, it wouldn't surprise me. There are well over a billion phones in active use right now. The cameras, one of the major apps that goes on that phone. I don't think it's possible, in fact, to market a smartphone successfully that doesn't have a great camera.
The way I look at technology is I want to use it more than it uses me. Like you said, you don't have privacy, but they know what you shop for and what you might shop for and those kinds of things. So that's always a little kind of scary.
You have to make a choice about what you're going to do, what you're going to use. I'm in control of my social media presence. I'm not on it.
There you go.
And I don't feel impoverished as a result of that. If people want to get in touch with me, if they have to make a little extra effort, that's fine. I don't like the thought of being tracked, and I don't like the thought of visiting upon other people details of my life that are profoundly trivial.
And as far as the talks that you'll be giving, is there one message that you want to underscore?
I think personally that America is at its best as a nation when it's inclusive. So I think a good test with regard to technology is how inclusive does it make the country? And matter of fact, how inclusive does it make the country in the world? How inclusive does it make an individual citizen? Or are we all just atoms in the universe interacting now and again? I think that's an important test.
That was business historian Richard Tedlow in town this week for lectures at UH. An expert on management, marketing, and strategy, he's the author of Giants of Enterprise, Andy Grove, and Denial, Why Business Leaders Fail to Look Facts in the Face. He's also writing a book on the subject of technology and inclusiveness and the digital divide.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine, Ulupono Initiative, and Impact Hub Honolulu Co-Working.
Reality Check is a segment that we have with our partner Honolulu Civil Beat, and Stuart is on the line with us. Morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Catherine.
So I think the last time I saw you, we were both covering a rail meeting at the Hart offices down there. That's where you were yesterday.
Yes, exactly.
So tell us, what's your story about?
So the story is the board that oversees Hart yesterday voted to allow Hart to enter into a public-private partnership with an entity, a private company, that will be in charge of designing, building, financing, and ultimately operating the rail. The design, build, and finance portion involves this last stretch that everyone talks about, the city center stretch that goes from really into town, from Kalihi or Middle Street to Ala Moana.
And I remember, you know, when there was all this talk about a private-public partnership, not everybody was convinced that this was really the best way to go. Some actually thought that, you know, maybe it wouldn't work.
Well, there's still that concern. And among those who voiced concern yesterday when we called for comment is Sylvia Luke, the chair of the legislature's House Finance Committee. She pointed out that it's not a sure thing, that this isn't necessarily the end all of solutions for the rail project to keep it on budget and on time, and she stressed that she really wants to make sure that this ends up with something that's either cost neutral or saves the taxpayers money.
Right, and I know, well, we're kind of beyond the on time and on budget, because this is kind of like a really balloon from when they first proposed this. But yeah, there is that concern about whether this P3, like they like to call it, the public-private partnership, is what's going to save us money, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, a lot needs to be done still, remember. And Mayor Caldwell, who supports the P3, as they call it, talked about that yesterday at the meeting. You know, he said, look, there still are risks associated with this. We need to be careful, or Hart needs to be careful, the way it negotiates. And it's going to be hard. You know, he likened it to climbing Mount Everest.
So he's not really convinced it's going to work either, it sounds.
Well, he thinks it's the right idea, but is just saying that you know, it so much depends on the details. And remember, we've still got, it's very early on. Hart has a lot of work to do. I think the first phase they discussed was putting together a list of qualified bidders. So they need to do that. And then there'll be bidding or requests for proposals, and then the proposals, then negotiations. So there's really a lot of work to do before this even gets finalized.
And I wonder, too, you know, they go through this whole process, and, you know, what if maybe, I don't know, there are no takers, there are no bidders out there, you know, and then where does that leave us?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, Andy Robbins, the CEO of Hart, had an op-ed the other day in the Star Advertiser saying that there are four or five interested parties. The Hart chair, Damian Kim, mentioned one of them yesterday. So it seems like they're confident that there will be some takers. But your question's a really good one, and I think a lot of the public has that one and is pretty skeptical.
Right, and this is the toughest segment on this route, the urban core. Lots of surprises that could pop up, even though, you know, they've tried to do the work to avoid some of the problems. But, you know, it's going to be tough with all the underground utilities and who knows what else they encounter on this last leg.
Oh, for sure. It's, remember, this is going from through Kalihi, and then it sort of skirts along the edge of Chinatown and downtown. It goes through Kaka'ako and to Ala Moana Center. So it's people are going to see this as it's happening, and it I imagine it can't avoid having some disruptions.
Right. So hang on to your
pocketbook. All right. Thanks a lot, Stuart.
Thank you, Catherine.
Every day we bring you a reality check from our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Stuart Yurton. To read his full story and more great news, check civilbeat.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Wealth Jar, Hawaii Pacific University, and Locations.
Elegant, whimsical, and eye-popping. That could describe the items you will see at Hawaii's Wood Show. Andy Cole is not only a woodworker, but one of the organizers of the exhibit. He stopped by earlier to chat up this year's events. Now, one of the showstoppers happens to be a dress made of koa. Think fish scales.
The dress is made by Paul Church, and it's a collaboration between Paul and Martin and MacArthur. Martin and MacArthur supplied the koa veneer, and Paul used his amazing artistic talents to put the dress together. And as was displayed Friday night, it's not just a static dress, it's wearable and movable.
Okay, there you go. So all kinds of different things, exploring different forms, I guess, for the woodworkers?
Yes, well, we always have a variety of different categories. We have, I think, six different categories. We have musical instruments, furniture, sculpture, turnings in two different categories. And so there's always a good variety.
And so tell us about how the show is judged.
Okay, it's judged. There's actually a couple different ways we break down the show. We have people who have won awards for a long time, and we've moved them into a category called the Masters category, and they're judged against one another regardless of the entry division that they enter in. The others are all separated by division, so musical instruments are judged against other musical instruments, sculptures against other sculptures. They're judged on quality of workmanship, utilization of the wood, new ideas.
And you don't really have a theme, but the whole focus of this show is really to showcase Hawaii's wood.
Yeah, that's basically it, and that's the theme since day one, which is we have such spectacular woods that grow here in Hawaii, and they grow with some care. They don't just happen by themselves. I mean, they do, but we have to care for our forests. And so what we're trying to showcase is the spectacular woods that grow here in Hawaii, that coupled together with the talent of the artisans that craft from those woods.
Is there a requirement to use like a certain percentage of certain woods?
It's not necessarily a percentage, but the focus does have to be Hawaiian-grown wood. There are certain circumstances where non-native woods are applicable, especially musical instruments and things like that. Oftentimes soundboards, turning hardware are oftentimes better used from other woods. But the main focus does have to be locally grown woods. And we also stay very clear of any endangered woods because we don't want to have those be exploited in any way.
Okay, endangered woods, you're talking?
There's a wide variety of endangered woods, but they're woods that are less common, threatened, and what we really try to focus on is not so much the endangered ones, but the abundant ones, and really try to get people to use the lesser-known abundant woods. I mean, koa has always been a favorite. Everybody wants to work with koa, but there are so many other spectacular woods that grow in abundance, and we really try and promote those, things like mango wood, monkey pod, Norfolk pine. They grow in abundance, and by doing exquisite artwork out of those, we create a demand for the woods that steers people away from endangered woods.
There was a beautiful ukulele that I saw made of mango wood.
Mm-hmm.
Just wonderful.
Yeah, mango is a beautiful wood, and it's probably one of my favorites. And mango goes through a lot of changes. When mango is first cut down, it's plain and yellow, has very little character, and as it sits in log form for a few months, it begins a decomposition process, and something called spalting, which is a fungus that grows in the wood, begins to give it vibrant colors, dark black lines. It just makes it really outstanding.
That's what I thought was kind of striking, was all the lines, and it just was really kind of eye-catching, eye-popping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's funny. Sometimes there are mango pieces that are so pretty, people look at them and they say, wow, is that koa? And we say, no, it's mango. And sometimes they're disappointed because they want koa. But the important thing is they were visually attracted to the wood.
And then I've seen just wonderful pieces made out of, is it Norfolk?
Norfolk pine, mm-hmm. and off it's a Norfolk pine and Cook pine, very similar. I've been told what's on the island here is most often Cook pine, not Norfolk, but it's so difficult to tell the difference. You can't really tell the difference by looking, so they're pretty much the same wood.
But it's a softer wood, right?
It's a very soft wood, it is. And when those are turned very thin, they become translucent, which can be really spectacular if you shine a little bit of light on a thin bowl.
Yeah, just really, just like luminescent, mm-hmm. kind of like shimmers, yep. really gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And so I understand that there was a challenge by someone to use albizia, but
nobody took up on the offer, and that was Ron Kent, who's a longtime, very well-known wood turner. He kind of pioneered the turning of translucent Norfolk pine, and I think it's very well known for that and helped to really make Norfolk popular. And one of the things that he's wanting to do is to create a legacy using albizia wood, and he was really hoping to get some people to jump in on the challenge. The challenge came in a little bit late this year, so it was a little bit difficult for people to get going on it, but the dangling carrot is out there, and so we expect that we will have takers on that in the coming years.
Right, because you've got lots of albizia.
Lots of albizia. Every time the wind blows, we have more.
And is there anything, I don't know, any particular pest that you know of that might be threatening any of our woods?
There are. That's not my area of expertise. I know one of the things that's been in the news a lot lately is the ohia, the rapid death, because there are lots of pests, microorganisms that get in and attack things. And one of the biggest problems is the transportation of wood, because it will attack a very localized area, and then when people carry logs from one place to another, whatever is causing the problem with that wood can move to another location. So that's something that we really try to be careful about, is the transport of raw lumber.
And I have seen some really beautiful, like, ohia wood floors, mm-hmm. just gorgeous.
Yeah, and oftentimes we'll get recycled wood. People will demolish a home and they'll take up the old ohia flooring and we'll reuse that wood for other purposes.
So with this show, I mean, it runs through October.
Yeah, Sunday, October 7th, correct, every day except Monday. And when I've worked in the show as a docent, I think the word that I hear most often when people walk through the door is, wow. They step through the door, their eyes get really big, they look around, they say, I've got to go put some more quarters in the meter. They go do that, and then they say, I'm bringing my friends back. One of the great things is absolutely free to come take a look at the pieces. It will cost a little bit if you fall in love with and decide you need to purchase it for your home, but you can look to your heart's content all day long, 10 until 5, Tuesday through Sunday. You will not regret it. Nobody has ever walked through and said, boy, that was a waste of time.
Okay, and did you have a favorite piece in the show?
That's a tough one, and as an artist, we are expected to vote on a favorite piece, and so I do have a favorite piece. I'm not sure if I should tell you what it is. There's 72 in there, and trying to pick a favorite is really difficult to do.
And is there a People's Choice Award?
There is a People's Choice Award every year, and so we encourage everybody who goes through to grab a ballot, pick one. And I think the toughest thing is people wander around and they say, I can't choose. We need them to pick one, because it's really hard if they write down everything is my favorite on the top of the ballot.
Okay, it's probably going to be like mine.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else that you think would be important for our listeners to know?
Well, I guess if they get down there and take a look, that will basically do it. Save some time, because I think so many times people walk in there and they realize they did not allocate enough time. So wander through, look at a piece from different angles. You'll spot things that you didn't see. We get people who come through the show for a second and third time, and they'll spot a piece they hadn't seen the first or second time through and say, wait a minute, I didn't see that before. So take some time. It's well worth the visit. You'll be really glad that you did.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Andy Cole.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That was Oahu woodworker Andy Cole talking about a free exhibit that opened this past weekend and runs through October 7th at the Honolulu Museum of Art School. So it's not around for very long, and if you're from the neighbor islands and you can make it to Honolulu over this next week, please do. This year, the entries will be available for purchase online. The exhibit featuring Hawaii's prized woods, everything from mango to koa to Norfolk pine, will be featured. Don't miss it. It's always a treat. Look for links on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.